Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we have a fascinating show on new publications focused on Hawaii's marine life from shallow to deep with some most interesting scientists. First, we will go to deep corals of the main and remote Hawaiian islands and then travel to the shallow waters looking at some of Hawaii's marine mammals. First up is a notorious pair of highly regarded scientists, Dr. Richard Pyle and Randy Kosaki. Randy is NOAA's Deputy Superintendent of the Papahanao Mokuakea Marine National Monument and received his PhD in zoology from the University of Hawaii. Rich Pyle is an associate zoologist with the Hawaii Biological Survey staff at the Bishop Museum. He also received a doctorate in zoology at the University of Hawaii, and both have long-standing research interests in ecology and taxonomy of Pacific coral reefs and coral reef fishes. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Carly. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So, both graduates from University of Hawaii, did you go to school together?
Well, we didn't go to school as kids, but we've known each other since we were teenagers. We both had a high fascination for keeping fish in aquariums and stuff like that, so we'd met each other. But I don't think we really got to know each other that well until I was an undergraduate at UH and Randy was a graduate student.
At which point, Rich led me astray into deeper water, and we've been diving together now for 30 years or more.
Oh, I imagine with such similar interests, you guys have been able to foster both a working relationship and a great friendship. So let's talk about this exciting new publication that's just come out and hit the academic stand, so to say. Why are Hawaii's deep reefs so special?
Well, this publication you refer to is sort of the culmination of a 20-year-long study. It goes back. It's got many major components to it, which were all brought together to sort of give this comprehensive review of these deep coral reefs in Hawaii. Now, deep coral reefs in general are relatively new on the science scene. We, you know, Randy and I have known about them for many years from all of our original deep diving exploits, but the broader academic community is sort of waking up to the fact that this 80% of coral reef habitat at depths below 100 and 500 feet, where nobody's really explored before, have a lot of science to offer and are just waiting to be documented. So that's really what this study was all about, for trying to characterize these deep reefs in Hawaii.
And has this reefs been characterized before, or was this kind of like the first exploration of these deep reef areas?
There have been other areas in the Pacific and the Caribbean where people have tried to explore deep coral reefs going back into the late 60s, I think, is where it all began. In fact, one of the first studies of these deep coral reefs was right here in Hawaii in the late 60s with a submersible. Then there were various studies throughout the Pacific and Caribbean up until about the 1990s, but very, very few. And it was really around the 2000s where people started paying attention, and diving technology allowed us to get access to those depths. And that's when it really started taking off.
Now, can you describe what some of these corals look like? I imagine they might be a little bit different than the ones we're normally used to seeing in shallower depths.
Well, the corals and also the fishes that we see in deep water are all of coral reef-associated genera. So some of them are, in fact, the same species that we see in shallow water. But in most cases, it's the close relatives of those that we see in shallow water. So they look kind of familiar, kind of like seeing someone's relative, like, I think I know who you are or who you're related to. So the fishes we see, a lot of them are common families of fishes. We see butterfly fish, damselfish, wrasses, and whatnot. But most of them are forms of those families that are unique to deep water.
And do they, they look similar, but are there distinguishing features that are common among some of the deep reef fish? You know, for some of the deep hydrothermal vent animals, you know, the deeper you go, the weirder they get. How do these animals look?
No, these are still coral reefs we're talking about. And so they're still coral reef fishes and coral reef corals. So they are readily identifiable as coral reef fishes.
Excellent. And what about some of the other species living in those coral reef areas in the deep waters? Do you see any other unique species or any endemic species to Hawaii?
Well, the fishes that we've been finding, the deeper you go, the more endemics you find. And those are species that are only found here in Hawaii. And also, as we move up the chain into the Papahanaumokuakea area, the levels of endemism also rise. so that when you're diving the deepest reefs at the northern extreme of the archipelago, we're seeing close to 100% endemism, which is off the scale globally.
Is there anywhere else in the world that has that kind of an endemism rate?
Well, the only place that's really similar is Rapa Nui or Easter Island, because like Hawaii, it's a Polynesian outlier. It's kind of a high-latitude coral reef system, so the water's a little cooler. It's isolated from other archipelagos, so you have isolation and endemism. And Rapa Nui shallow water is known to have upwards of 70% of its species being endemic. So it is sort of a parallel to the northwestern Hawaiian Islands.
And is there a common coral that you're seeing that's predominantly at this depth, or is there a variety of corals?
Well, it depends on where you go. Here in the main Hawaiian Islands, for example, off of Maui in the Au'au Channel, there are extensive beds of hard corals, these plate stony corals in the genus Leptoceras. We're not entirely sure which species are represented there, but they absolutely dominate some of these habitats. You know, the tens of square kilometers of near 100% coral cover down at 300 feet, which is essentially unprecedented in the world. There's a few other places on Earth. Okinawa has similar corals at maybe 250 to 260 feet. There's a spot in the Gulf of Mexico where they have maybe 70% coral cover in some areas, not quite as deep. But these areas off Maui and also off Kauai have tremendous 100% coral cover expansive reefs that we just don't see anywhere else. Now, in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, you don't see those kinds of corals. You get into different kinds of environments down those deep. So it depends on where in Hawaii you go.
Well, I just can't imagine diving on some of these reef areas. What does it feel like to be going to these depths and seeing these corals that not many people have been able to look at before?
Well, it's exciting. It's always exciting. I mean, this is why Randy and I love science, is because of discovery and exploration. It's sort of going into areas that have never been seen before and seeing things that no one's ever been seen before. That's really, for me at least, the fuel that drives this passion for exploration and discovery. And so, you know, it's exciting. And Randy and I both use this technology called closed-circuit rebreathers, which is sort of high-tech scuba. It's computer-controlled scuba, and we don't exhale bubbles like scuba divers do. It's called a rebreather because we recirculate the same breath over and over. And that technology requires a lot of training and a lot of preparation. So there's quite a bit of pre-dive organization. So, you know, that's usually at the forefront of our mind before the dive. But once the dive starts, all of that sort of disappears, and our focus is on getting to the bottom quickly and seeing what we can find.
So with these rebreathers, I mean, how long is a dive typically lasting for you? And I imagine, do you have to have the same type of safety stop as you would on normal?
Yeah, so it depends on how deep we go and how long we stay. Now, one advantage of rebreathers is it changes the gas mixture according to our depth, which actually makes it better than regular scuba. Regular scuba, you're stuck with whatever gas you're breathing. So we can increase the efficiency of decompression. Decompression is what requires us to come up slowly on the way up. However, because we're going so deep and staying so long, we're still in the water a very long time. So here in Hawaii, when we dive up in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, for example, we'll stay maybe 20, 25 minutes on the bottom and probably decompress for about maybe 2 hours or so. Elsewhere in the Pacific, we'll go down deeper, down to 500 feet. We'll stay longer, up to an hour sometimes, and be in the water for as long as 8 hours. So yeah, it can get pretty long sometimes.
So how do you guys entertain yourself during those safety stops? That's a two-hour safety stop, is it? Is a long time.
Well, one of the best ways is just by watching the sharks swim in circles around you. I never get tired of that.
That would be amazing to see, definitely. Excellent. And so when you're in these unique areas called the mesophotic zone or twilight zone, what depth range are we talking about here, and what makes it different than some of the deeper or shallower water or ecosystems we're looking at?
Well, generally, this mesophotic coral ecosystem, or twilight zone, as we like to call it, is kind of loosely defined as the coral reef habitat between about 100 feet and about 500 feet. Now, the 100-foot limit is sort of the limit at which most scuba diving scientists have spent most of their time. It's sort of arbitrarily defined at that depth. The 500-foot limit seems to be about the lower limit of where you get a thriving coral reef-type ecosystem. Up shallow, the corals are dominated by these stony hard corals. They're called scleractites. Argentinian corals. And, you know, throughout the Pacific and Caribbean, you'll see these extensive coral reefs that people think of as coral reefs. Now, there's a few exceptional places, like the Ao Ao Channel here in Hawaii, where you find the same kinds of corals down deep. But across the Pacific, mostly the deep coral reefs are dominated by different kinds of corals, specifically Gorgonian corals. They're called sea fans. The habitat is a whole different nature down there. But as Randy mentioned earlier, most of the fishes and many of the other organisms are clearly coral reef-associated fishes, even though it's a different kind of coral and a deeper environment.
So in diving in these different places like the Maine and northwestern Hawaiian Islands and elsewhere, is there a favorite location that you have dove on before?
Well, in the Hawaiian archipelago, I think the further up the chain you go, the better it gets until you get to the very northern end, Pearl and Hermes Atoll, Midway Atoll, Kure Atoll. That's where we've been finding very close to 100% endemism. Some of these are fishes that had only been seen from submersibles or collected from trawls at 800 or 900 feet. So it's a really unique sightseeing opportunity, if you will. Now, there's a price to pay. As you go further north, it gets colder. Because the Hawaiian archipelago, it starts at 19 degrees north latitude on the Big Island, and Kure Atoll is at almost 29 degrees. So you're 50% further north than you are here in the main Hawaiian Islands. And at 300 feet, 330 feet, we're hitting temperatures in the mid-50s, high 50s Fahrenheit. And so there's nothing tropical about that. I mean, that's like California in November is in the mid-50s. So it is chilly.
So what kind of wetsuit are you diving with on these deeper dives?
Well, our same shallow water wetsuits. The curse and the blessing of diving deep is you don't have very much time, so you don't get very much work done, but you don't stay long enough to get really cold either. And then you come back up and decompress in warmer water.
Excellent. Well, it's good to hear. So let's talk a little bit about the research you have done recently that this release was about. So up until the last couple years, we've been learning so much because we didn't know that much before. What has changed with this study, and what did you find that was so surprising in this work?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that emerged from this work. Now, for us, like I say, we've been working on this for 20 years, so some of these things aren't necessarily new to us, but we just synthesized them all in this one large paper. But I would say the most amazing things for me personally that came out of this long, protracted research project was, one, how extensive these hard coral reefs are off Maui and Kauai. Just, you know, acres and acres of 100% coral cover is just unprecedented. That was just truly amazing. And I would say the other thing is what Randy was alluding to earlier, this high rate of endemism. The deeper you go, the more species you encounter that are only found within the Hawaiian Islands. And so down at 300 feet on our surveys in the main islands, you know, roughly half of the species were unique, whereas less than a quarter were unique in the shallow reefs. And then, as Randy said, the further up the northwestern Hawaiian island chain you go, the higher the rate of endemism is. So I would say the fact that this trend towards higher rates of endemism down deeper is one of, you know, for me, one of the most exciting things that came out of this project.
And in terms of conservation applications, could these deeper reefs seed shallow reef habitat at all, or is there not much mixing between the two? And that's a question of, I'm naive in that, I have no idea.
Well, that's been posed as a hypothesis, that these deep reefs might be a refuge for things that are getting hammered by climate change or getting overfished in shallow water. There doesn't seem to be an across-the-board one-size-fits-all answer. It's probably going to be fairly species-specific. Because some of the corals that we find in deep water, like the Leptoceras, that provides almost 100% coral cover off of Maui, is exclusively a deep water coral. You don't find it in shallow water. So is that species likely to recolonize shallow water in the event of a major bleaching event? Probably not. But there are other species of shallow water corals that we'll find 150, 200 feet that may play that role. I mean, last year we were out diving off of Maui during the peak of the main Hawaiian Islands bleaching event. And all of the corals in shallow water were turning white and bleaching. But at 200 feet, we were finding many of those same corals in extensive stands that were not bleached. So in some cases, the deep reefs may be able to be that refuge for shallow waters.
I smell another research project.
Or two.
Excellent. And with this extensive cover, let's say even in the main Hawaiian Islands, in areas where it's not as protected as the monument, Are these corals under threat, or because they're deeper, they're better protected?
So that's a really good question, and one that we're still not quite sure we know. There's a general presumption that the shallower reefs are in greater threat than the deep reefs just because they're closer to human activity. Sure. But there's also some very good reasons to suspect the opposite. For example, these deep reefs live at sort of the absolute limit of the available sunlight that drives photosynthesis. Now, if you increased land-based, say, development, and you had some runoff, that might increase the turbidity, the murkiness of the water, you know, by a little bit. And that little bit may not affect shallow reefs so much, but it might be just what's needed to essentially shut out the lights for these deep reefs. So there's a plausible, you know, reason to suspect that some of these deep reefs may be actually more vulnerable. Also, in terms of temperature, you know, it's really hard to predict what's going to happen. The shallower reefs are subjected to higher temperatures. But on the other hand, the corals and the other organisms living down on the deep reefs are used to much more stable temperatures. So if you have a truly anomalous climactic event or an El Nino that pushes warm water down deep, they may be less tolerant of that kind of dynamic. So we're still just beginning to get a sense for whether or not the deep reefs are more vulnerable or less vulnerable than the shallow reefs. And as Randy said, it's probably species specific, and it's probably specific location specific.
Sure. And did you see any bleaching when you guys were doing your work at all?
We have not seen any bleaching per se down deep. We've seen potential coral diseases, you know, little cysts on some of these corals. We don't know if that's normal or higher than normal. And a big part of the problem is we don't really have a baseline for these deep coral reefs, so we don't know what normal is. And that's what we're hoping this study sort of serves to represent, is at least, well, here's what it was at this period in history.
Sure, absolutely. Well, such fascinating work. I want to hear a lot more about the methods and the crews that you guys did. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to learn more about our deep reefs.
Quarterback looking, firing across the middle. Wow, what a grab in traffic. Larson really had defenders hanging all over, but somehow he comes up with the football.
On the football field, you've got to stay focused and not get distracted.
NFL Hall of Famer and President and CEO of CTIA, the Wireless Association, Steve Largent.
The same is true on the road. So before your wireless phone becomes a distraction, take a timeout for safety. Place your phone in easy reach before you leave. Never take notes or look up a phone number while you're driving. In bad weather or traffic, call later. Dial sensibly and use a hands-free device. You know, your wireless phone can be your best safety tool to call for help, stop a crime, or help someone in need. However you use it, remember, with wireless, safety is your call.
The wireless industry reminds you to drive safely. For more information, visit www.wirelesssafety.org.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we are talking about Hawaii's unique animals. And right now we are focusing on the deep with Dr. Richard Pyle and Dr. Randy Kosaki. So let's go to the actual cruise and study and talk about that for a little bit. Tell me more about this work. Was it one particular cruise, or is this a series of research cruises and studies that have taken place over time?
Yeah, this is a series of cruises. Some of them were in the main Hawaiian Islands, again, focused on that Maui area that we've been talking a lot about. And the other half of the project focused on the northwestern Hawaiian Islands and Papahanaumokuakea. But it was virtually all done off of NOAA ships. And so the methods are similar. The cast of characters, the people participating were similar. So it's virtually a seamless study from one end of the archipelago to the other.
Excellent. And so for those of us that aren't used to going out to sea and seeing the normal cast of characters, can you illustrate, like, what would a typical day look like when you're out at sea doing one of these dives?
Generally, it starts fairly early. I mean, we work long days because time at sea is so valuable, you can't waste a minute. So generally, we start 6 in the morning prepping gear, loading boats, and we're at it all day. We come back for a hot dinner and a shower, and then it's data entry and specimen processing well into the late hours of the evening. So it's not uncommon to work 15, 16, 17-hour days every day for a month straight.
Wow. But I imagine the reward is so worth it that in the end, it's okay working all those hours.
Oh, absolutely. It's like being on parole to get out of the office for a month and go diving.
Just crave it. So once you're out there, I mean, how are you doing these dives? I know that there was also some robotics work with the crews. How did that get divided up?
Well, we had a whole plethora of different kinds of technologies. We had some ROVs, these robotic underwater cameras. We also had submersibles with people inside of them, and we had these rebreathers. And we did our best on this project to try to integrate those technologies as much as possible and leverage the strengths of each. You know, each one has different strengths and weaknesses. So that was one of the exciting aspects of this particular project, was being able to use those technologies side by side.
So why are submersibles so important to this work?
Well, submersibles are really powerful tools for exploring deep ecosystems because, first of all, the occupants of the submersible are safely kept at one atmosphere pressure, so they're not exposed to the decompression hazards and sharks and other things that, you know, divers are exposed to. Also, submarines can stay underwater very long time. Eight hours is a typical dive done here in Hawaii, and they can go much, much deeper than divers can go. You know, divers are pretty much limited to do science at about 500 feet. Beyond that, even that's pretty crazy. Beyond that, it just starts to become impractical. So submarines can go deeper and stay longer and keep the occupants, you know, much, much safer. They can also carry heavier equipment up and down. What divers have to their advantage is the ability to get inside coral reefs much more intimately, much more closely, collect specimens, you know, go inside caves, do sorts of things that submarines can't do. And the way we leverage both of those technologies on this project is, for example, we had the submarine take down this acrylic dome that was too heavy for the divers to take down, but required divers to really conduct an experiment. The dome was placed over a coral head and the coral was exposed to certain chemicals, and you know, that required divers to do that sort of manipulation. And so it was a really good example of how the submarine and the diver were working together to do some science that would have been impossible for either to do by themselves.
And that's super unique too, to have a submersible and divers working in the water at the same time. What was that experience like?
Well, it was really exciting for us as divers. I mean, that's just, you know, I can't tell you how cool it is to sort of drop through the blue water and then you see this little pinpoint of light. And as you approach the pinpoint of light, you see it's attached to this big submersible and we just sort of land near it. And it was neat being able to look in the portholes and wave to our friends on the inside. And you know, it was exciting for me as sort of a technology nerd to combine those technologies. But also it had great practical advantages, too, for doing these kinds of studies we wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
Well, I hope you got some good pictures.
We did, lots, yes.
So you talk about doing this experiment working together with the submersible. What other types of work does the submersible do besides bringing down equipment? Because I know that they're capable of quite a bit.
Right. Well, the submarine does a lot of stuff. It can collect a lot of samples. It can collect corals and algae. And, you know, it can collect fishes. It's a little bit harder to collect fishes from a submarine. A diver is actually much better at collecting fishes. But what submarines can do is really cover a lot of ground. They can, you know, cover miles underwater, and so they can cover a lot more territory. They can do quantitative surveys along transect lines. They can get a much better sense for what the big picture of a reef looks like. The diver's real advantage is being able to get deep down into the reef very closely and see very small fishes and small invertebrates that you might not be able to see through the porthole of a submarine.
Excellent. And besides the dome experiment, what other things were you doing? I'm guessing some fish and coral sampling, but what else was happening underwater?
Well, yeah, we did. Well, actually, Randy could talk more about that. He did some coral reef fish transects and things, and we did some collection of specimens.
Yeah, we also do quantitative fish counts or fish censuses, which is another one of those things that divers can do much better than a submersible. You could use a sub to count fish, but it's kind of like using a tank to count deer in the forest. You know, it's not subtle and you're going to have a lot of impact on the behavior of the species you're watching. So divers are actually very good for conducting ecological surveys and censuses.
Well, and being able to do accurate fish counts is not something that you can just pick up one day. It takes a lot of practice. And I know you've been doing it for so long, Randy. What are some of your techniques that you use to get an accurate count?
Well, it's practice, really. It's something you need to stay in shape for. They've done some very good studies that have found that it takes somewhere between 30 and 50 transects before your data are really getting good, so to speak. And so you need to keep practicing and do it regularly to keep that skill up.
Excellent. And So the rebreather diving, when you're down there, I'm guessing that you might even get a little bit closer to the fish because you don't have all the bubbles disturbing the water. Do you get a more intimate experience?
Yeah, well, so the rebreathers don't make this bubble noise like scuba divers do, and they're much quieter. And there have been some studies comparing rebreather transects to scuba diving transects, and they get some differences in the kinds of fishes we've seen. Anecdotally, you know, I see much more fish sex, for example, when I'm on a rebreather than I ever used to on scuba. And you get this sense that you're not an intruder sort of, you know, interloper looking into the reef. You feel more like part of the reef. And, you know, I have many, many examples where I've seen behaviors and things that I'd never seen before as a scuba diver. So they're definitely much more stealthy in that way.
Amazing. And then there was also some mapping work being done. I'm guessing that was the submersible.
Well, we also do multi-beam sonar mapping from the ships, oftentimes at night when the divers are sleeping. And what the multi-beam sonar generates is a very complex, accurate, three-dimensional picture of the reef. And so that's an invaluable tool for selecting dive sites. When you're diving in 300 feet, you can't just look over the side of the boat and go, oh, yeah, this looks good. You know, you don't want to waste a dive and have to do all the decompression to find out that there's nothing but sand down there. So the multi-beam sonar is an invaluable tool. And we have a lot more mapping to do before we're done characterizing Hawaii. Literally, we have better maps of the moon than we have of our deep coral reefs. So we've got lifetimes of work yet to do.
Well, that's good for employment.
It's job security.
And what about all of those younger listeners or the younger generation of marine scientists that are saying, thinking, you know, how cool to be diving underwater with robots and these deep corals, seeing fish sex, all kinds of crazy things are happening down there. What advice would you give to those interested in doing this type of diving?
Well, when I give talks to, you know, high school kids and younger kids, I usually say, you know, if you follow a career of science, first of all, do well in school. You have to, you know, you have to really be, if you're going to be an academic, you have to sort of learn how to learn. But also don't expect a career where you'll be driving Lamborghinis and living in mansions, because scientists don't really go down a career path where there's lots of money. What they do, though, is they enjoy almost every day of their life. And so rather than work 50 weeks out of the year so they can have a 2-week wonderful vacation and spend their money, scientists literally wake up every morning excited to get to work and do what they love to do. And so I would say in general, if you really like the natural world and you feel like, you know, science might be a good career for you, then prepare to have a very enjoyable life.
Randy, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, just that Rich and I feel very lucky, because for us, this is sort of a hobby that's gotten way out of control. So, you know, it's something we're passionate about. If it's something that young people are passionate about, I would say by all means pursue it, because there isn't anything better than getting paid to do your hobby.
That's very true. And you get to see a lot of the world, too, doing this type of work. So, as well, for those of us that don't publish in academic journals, this isn't something that was, you know, published in a newspaper or in a public book. I mean, it's available to anyone who's interested. But what is that academic process like? And why is there such a delay between when you do the research till when the actual publication comes out?
Yeah, well, it depends on what the specific science is. But a lot of times, you know, you go out and you collect your data, when that may involve diving, that may involve remote technologies. But once you have your data, there's quite a bit of analysis that needs to be done. And that can quite often take a bit of time. But then the publication process, well, you have to sort of synthesize all this information and draft it up in a way that's, you know, makes sense and follows the scientific method. Then you submit this manuscript to a journal. Then it goes through peer reviews. And the peer review process, you know, your colleagues anonymously review your paper and will oftentimes be quite critical, but usually very constructively so. So that requires you to sort of go back, reanalyze your data. It's sort of this iterative process. In this particular paper, we had 16 authors from multiple institutions covering 20 years of data. It was quite a bit of cat herding to get it all to come together in the very end. So it actually just took a lot of time to really put all the pieces together in the review process. You know, the reviewers were fantastic. They were very meticulous and very thorough, which was a double-edged sword. It was great because it made the paper better, but it was also a lot of work to incorporate all their suggested changes, which we eventually were able to do. But that's kind of why this process is a bit arduous, going back and forth and getting it done.
Well, I think it also is important because, you know, it keeps the science accurate and also allows for these types of studies to get published to the academic communities worldwide and scientists and managers. Where can people learn more about deep reefs if they don't want to go to necessarily an academic publication but are very curious to learn about
these areas? Right now, that you know, the science is still just kind of exploding right now. If you look at the history of publications on these deep coral reefs in the last, five, six, 7 years is when really there have been hundreds of new publications. So we're kind of at the dawn of this understanding, and it hasn't percolated out into more popular websites. Now, we have a few blog sites at our Bishop Museum website where we've talked about our cruises, and, you know, we report on what happens on these dives and what we find. So that might be interesting. And there are various other websites out there where you can find some information and a few documentary films, but it'll probably be another year before there's really robust general information out there.
And I'd also add that on our last cruise this past June, Rich Pyle and Brian Green, another Bishop Museum diver, brought back a number of these deep reef fishes alive for public display. So some of them are at the Bishop Museum. There's a few at the Waikiki Aquarium. And over in Hilo at our Moku Papapa Discovery Center, we also have quite a few of these live fishes. So that's another educational venue where people can actually see some of these deep reef organisms.
Well, that's great. I am definitely going to go check those out now. That's fantastic. I also smell a book coming, maybe in the future.
Yeah, I think it's still a little premature for a book, but somewhere down the line, this all should be summarized somehow.
So what's next? We have just kind of hit the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, of this research and of these environments. Are there plans for more cruises or more research in the future?
Well, there will always be more cruises to Papahanaumokuakea. That's a given. But now that this paper is out and we've done a fairly comprehensive job of characterizing Hawaii's mesophotic coral ecosystems, now it's time to branch out into comparative studies, biogeographic studies between Hawaii and similar locations throughout the rest of the Pacific. So I think that's where the next few years will lead us.
So where's first on the hit list? Johnston?
Well, Rapa Nui, or Easter Island, like we just discussed, is another hotspot of endemism and biodiversity. So that's pretty high on our list.
Yeah, we have a few other sites. Ponape, we've been going back to now for several years in a row in the heart of Micronesia, and we're finding some really interesting things there. Solomon Islands, Palau. There's a few areas where we've been to before but want to get back more because we want to start seeing how these patterns apply across the whole Pacific, not just in particular sites like Hawaii.
Well, I look forward to following you both and seeing where you end up next and learn more about this exciting research. Thank you so much for your time, and I really appreciate you being able to be here today.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you, Carly.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're moving to shallow waters to talk about some marine mammals with Dr. Robin Baird.
You mean I could have diabetes and not even know it?
Then why would I want to know?
Heart disease, amputations, stroke, blindness can all be caused by diabetes. So it's critical that you know. If you're over 45, you don't exercise, and you're overweight, you're at risk. But a simple blood test can detect the problem, and with early treatment, you can prevent the devastating effects of diabetes. Call the American Diabetes Association at 1-800-DIABETES. Don't be blind to diabetes.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice.
What if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home,
should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. Today we are connecting with some of Hawaii's fascinating scientists with recent publications. Up now is Dr. Robin Baird, a research biologist at Cascadia Research and an affiliate faculty at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Robin is a well-known marine mammal biologist who has a long-standing research project in Hawaii and is a member of the Scientific Committee of Advisors for the U.S. Marine Mammal Commission. Robin, you were back with us on the show, I think maybe 3 years ago now. Welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thank you.
So since you visited us last, a few things have happened. First, congratulations on your new book.
Thank you. Yeah, it's very exciting. I just got the first advanced copies on Friday.
So I'm staring at this new copy of The Lives of Hawaii's Dolphins and Whales. Beautiful cover, by the way. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, we've been working in Hawaii for the last 17 years and publishing a lot of our work in scientific papers, scientific journals. But you know, one of the things we do when we're out in the water is we take a lot of people who are working on the water on different whale or dolphin watching boats or fishermen or various people who are interested in marine conservation. And over the years, they just have so many questions about what we're seeing and what different species are doing here in Hawaii and why they're here and what are the threats that they're facing. And so I realized that there was a tremendous need to be able to take all the information that we've been collecting and publishing in scientific journals and put it together in a place that's more accessible to the general public.
So flipping through these, through the book, is kind of like having the culmination of 17 years of going out on the water. I mean, some of these images are just spectacular, and they're all based in Hawaii, correct?
Yeah, the book has 173 photos, maps, and illustrations all together, and I think all but about 8 of them are from Hawaii. There's a few species that I cover in the book that have been recorded in Hawaiian waters but have never been really well photographed here, like minke whales, for example. Another species that's probably in Hawaiian waters, it's found to the north of Hawaiian waters but has never been documented here, so I used a photograph of that. It's a common dolphin from elsewhere. But all the other photos are from Hawaii, photos that we took in our research, as well as some just amazing photos by various other folks who work on the water here.
I know, just as I was thumbing through the book, I opened up a page and there's an orca with a shark in its mouth.
Yeah, so in that case, we had a group of killer whales off the Big Island in November of 2013, and the day after we saw them, one of our collaborating researchers basically got out and found the group again, and when he found them the next day, they were feeding on a thresher shark.
It's a good day in the office.
Yes, absolutely.
So, and I mean, some of these marine mammals, most people, if you would ask, when you think of orcas or killer whales, you don't think of Hawaii, you think of Pacific Northwest, but we do in fact have orcas in Hawaiian waters.
Yeah, there's really a tremendous diversity of species of whales and dolphins here. People tend to think about humpback whales and spinner dolphins, but there's 6 other species of baleen whales that are found in Hawaiian waters, one that's actually out there year-round, and the other 5 that migrate like humpback whales during the winter months to Hawaiian waters. And then there's 18 different species of odontocetes, tooth whales and dolphins, that are found in Hawaiian waters, and those 18 different species are actually here year-round. Some of them are resident to the islands, and some of them are just passing through the area, but there's still sort of broad open ocean populations like killer whales. There's no resident population of killer whales in Hawaiian waters, but they're certainly out in offshore waters on a regular basis.
So how many marine mammals in total do we have in Hawaii? And besides the minke whale and the common dolphin, have you seen them all?
Well, we've seen all 18 species of tooth whales here. We've only actually seen 2 of the species of baleen whales, the other one other than humpbacks, which of course are here in great abundance in the winter months, that we've seen are fin whales. And fin whales, like humpback whales, the population in the Gulf of Alaska and along the West Coast is recovering. So I actually suspect that sightings of fin whales are going to be increasing in Hawaiian waters over time. There's some species like blue whales, which are actually in Hawaiian waters every winter. And we know that based on acoustic research that's been done by various researchers where they have bottom-mounted microphones or hydrophones, and blue whales produce these very loud calls that can be heard over probably 50 or 100 kilometers or more. And so we know the blue whales are out there, but they've actually only ever been documented by researchers on just a single occasion in Hawaiian waters. So there's a lot of species like that. Minke whales, another small baleen whale, so it's a small cousin of the humpback whale and the blue whale and the fin whale. They're in Hawaiian waters all winter long, and yet there's only ever been, I think, 2 documented sightings of minkes.
So if you see blue whales or minke whales in the water, make sure you snap some pictures, is what you're telling us.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so identifying all these marine mammals can be tricky. I mean, they're not spending a lot of their time out of the water. When you're out there, how are you identifying them?
Well, in our work, we try to get good photos of every group we encounter so we can look at some of the subtle features. But in the book, I actually provide advice on how to identify some of the really difficult to identify species. And so, for example, telling the difference between a false killer whale and a pilot whale, or a pygmy killer whale and a melon-headed whale. They superficially look very similar, but you can use subtle differences of pigmentation or the relative size of the dorsal fin to identify those species. So it can be challenging, and we've made mistakes ourselves. You know, one time we found a group of small black whales that we thought were pygmy killer whales, and when we got the photographs back, we realized they were melon-headed whales. So even scientists can make mistakes at that.
Well, I'm sure it's not always easy to be able to tell the difference. So the book covers really two themes of natural history and conservation. What are some of the biggest marine mammal conservation issues that the book talks about or that we deal with here in Hawaii?
You know, there's a lot of different conservation issues, and most of them are related to just the sheer population growth of humans in Hawaii over the last 150, 200 years. Some of the conservation issues, I guess I would say, are local, and some are more global. So a global one is things like persistent organic pollutants, pesticides, flame retardants that you get in furniture, PCBs, which are an industrial chemical. Persistent organic pollutants are, there's never been huge inputs of those into the marine environment here in Hawaii, but those types of pollutants are transmitted in ocean currents, are transmitted in dust particles in the air. And so because of use of those types of chemicals in places like Asia, they sweep across the ocean and show up in whales and dolphins here in Hawaii. The one species that has the highest levels of pollutants here in Hawaii are actually false killer whales, and that's because they are feeding it basically at the top of the food web. They're feeding on other pelagic predators like ahi and ono and mahi-mahi.
Interesting. And so what are some of the more local conservation threats that we see here?
Yeah, well, I think everyone knows that the Hawaiian waters are home to U.S. Pacific Fleet, U.S. Navy, and there they do training exercises and testing of various equipment systems that tend to produce a lot of noise. So the biggest one from the Navy is a mid-frequency active sonar that they use basically on surface vessels to try to detect submarines. And there are some species in Hawaiian waters that are very susceptible to the impacts of Navy sonar. That includes cuviers, beaked whales. There's a resident population of cuviers off of the island of Hawaii, Blainville's beaked whales. There's also a resident population off the island of Hawaii. And then it also includes a few other species like melon-headed whales and dwarf sperm whales. So one of the types of research that we're doing out here and that we're trying to do is try to understand what the impacts of Navy sonar are on different species of whales and dolphins in Hawaii. And, you know, part of that is looking at where the different species spend their time. Are the populations resident to the islands, or are they sort of moving through? And a lot of our work in the last 6 or 7 years has been funded by the U.S. Navy, particularly to work off of Kauai and Niihau, with the goal of trying to understand what the impacts of Navy sonar are.
So we just talked to Rich and Randy, who, you know, were talking about a scientific publication. How does this book differ from the other scientific publications work that you've done?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that I tried to do is just make the information as available to everyone in the general public as possible. So it's written for people who work on the water, or people who are interested in marine life in Hawaii, people who are interested in marine conservation in Hawaii. So while it includes a tremendous amount of scientific information, I've included basically the background that you need to understand the science, you know, why we're doing the different type of research and how we're collecting the information, and then what the main results are. And it's focused on our research to a large degree, but I've tried to bring in as much information from large vessel surveys that National Marine Fisheries Service has been doing throughout the archipelago, as well as sort of a historical perspective of researchers like Ken Norris, who was in Hawaiian waters in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, working on first actually on spotted dolphins here off Oahu, and then later on spinner dolphins off the Big Island. And so it's just trying to bring all of that information together and make it available for anyone who's interested.
Now, I imagine in your research you're not covering all of these species. Are there particular marine mammals that you're focusing your work on when you're going out in the water?
Yeah, well, I first came to Hawaii in 98 and moved to Maui and started doing research there. And at that time, almost everyone in Hawaii that was working on whales was working on humpbacks, and everyone who's working on dolphins was working on spinners. So my original goal was not to compete or overlap with them. And so instead, we basically focused our efforts on other species. That said, when we go out on the water, we spend some time with every species of whale or dolphin we see. It's more how much time we spend with a species. So if we see something that's quite rare, like we had an encounter a couple days ago off of Waianae with pygmy killer whales, we stayed with them as long as we could, basically to get good photos of everyone in the group. We collected a genetic sample to help understand the population structure of that species, and we also deployed a satellite tag. And so with the rarely seen species, those are our priority. And it's, you don't see them very often, so you have to take advantage of the opportunity when it comes up.
So when you're out on the water, your protocols are, when you find a marine mammal, you take some pictures and you make some notes about the size of the group. What else are you looking for in these populations?
Yeah, well, we record a lot of different information during encounters. From basic stuff like where we first see them, and then we can look at what depth they're in. We can compare that to what depth that we search for animals, so we can say that some species are preferentially used really deep water or really shallow water. We record group size and the how spread a group apart is. We're taking sometimes thousands of photos during an encounter. We had an encounter with false killer whales on Monday where we probably took over 2,000 photos. And when you combine the information from the photos with the group size, you can start to get a better idea of social organization. A lot of it is not just what you get from a single encounter, but what you get from multiple encounters of the same social group over time. We also record whether we see them feeding or not, whether what their behaviors, are they resting, traveling, socializing, or feeding. And that tells us something about their day-night patterns. So some species appear to rest all day long, and other species seem to feed during the day. And so it helps us understand why they're using the islands and what they're doing here. We also record if there's any newborn calves in the group or any young in the group. If we can, some species you can tell the difference between a male and a female pretty easily, so we record the number of adult males we may see in a group, and all of that gets at things like, do they give birth year-round? Are the groups, in terms of social organization, do you see groups that are composed only of males, or are they sort of mixed-sex groups?
Interesting. And what's the most unique behavior that you've observed from a marine mammal during your work in Hawaii?
Well, probably the most unusual behavior is with false killer whales, and they're my favorite species. They're the only species of whale or toothed whale or dolphin in Hawaii, other than sperm whales, that are listed as endangered here in Hawaiian waters. But the thing about false killer whales is they're cooperative hunters. They're like wolves or lions, where they'll work together to basically chase down fish, and in their case, they're chasing down ahi or mahi-mahi or ono. When they catch the fish, it's a very typical behavior where one whale may initially find a big fish, and it tends to vocalize quite loudly, and you can see other whales converging from the distance, and all come in and all sort of participate in the hunt. They do like to play with their lunch. They'll, you know, throw mahi-mahi up in the air. But then what's most interesting is that they share their prey, and it's not just the sharing the prey between a mother and a calf. Often one will catch the mahi-mahi and then pass it over to another whale, and that whale will pass it over to a third whale, and then it'll pass it back to the first one again. It has a very interesting sort of social, ritualistic kind of nature to it.
That's incredible. And is that behavior only seen in Hawaii, or has that been observed elsewhere?
Well, false killer whales are we know more about false killer whales here in Hawaii than anywhere else, so there haven't been a lot of studies of them elsewhere. They certainly do share prey elsewhere, but I'm not sure that anyone's ever documented that type of prey sharing where they're not actually feeding on the fish as they pass it back and forth.
Amazing. That's just incredible. And you caught some really interesting footage of this just the other day on the boat, didn't you?
Yeah, no, we one of the things we do is we have a bunch of GoPros on board, and when they're hunting, if the circumstances are good, we'll have someone with a GoPro on a pole over the side of the boat. And we had one mahi-mahi that the boat was basically in neutral, and the mahi-mahi was hiding underneath the boat. False killer whales basically came in order to try to get the mahi-mahi out, and they eventually did, but we got some beautiful footage of it. So you can see that footage on our webpage if you're interested.
Definitely a plug to go check that out. And for people who've never seen a false killer whale, I imagine people are picturing, I don't know, like a killer whale that's not a killer whale, but they don't look like killer whales at all.
Yeah, no, they got their name, false killer whale. They were first described from a skeletal specimen, and the skull of a false killer whale looks very similar to the skull of a killer whale. So the scientific name, instead of Orcinus orca, the scientific name is Pseudorca for false killer whale. But yeah, they don't look anything alike, but they are actually fairly closely related to killer whales, although they're more closely related to pilot whales.
Yeah, they would look more like pilot whales
to me.
Yes,
they do, yeah.
Amazing. And so you have these full amazing days out on the boat. Sometimes some days are better than others, but the work doesn't stop when you get to the harbor. There's a lot more that happens. So describe for us what you do after you get back to shore, because that's not where it ends.
Yeah, well, there's sort of what you do that evening and then what you do for the next 4 to 6 months type of thing. We, you know, we typically have 3 or 4 cameras out at all times to get photos from groups. So we I think on one of our better days this last weekend, we took over 8,000 photographs.
Wow.
So just downloading all the photographs and renaming them and then backing them up onto multiple hard drives so you don't have to worry about losing them takes a while. We're collecting these little remote biopsy samples that give us a sort of a pencil eraser piece of skin and a little bit of blubber, and those all need to be subsampled and then frozen for later analysis. We send those off to genetics labs or toxicology labs or folks that are working on things like stress hormones or reproductive hormones at Hawaii Pacific University. We also, if we deploy satellite tags, that information we retrieve from, actually it comes from NOAA weather satellites through the Argos system. And that's most interesting for me because we tend to be limited as to where we can work to areas that are relatively calm. So we tend to work on the leeward sides of the islands. But once we tag an animal, then it can go anywhere it wants. And so we tagged a false killer whale off Waianae 2 days ago. After we tagged it, it headed north up the west side of Oahu. Then it turned east and up to the north tip of the island. And yesterday it was heading down the east side of the island. And this morning it's over on Penguin Bank.
Wow.
And so, you know, we're restricted to Waianae because that's where the seas are calm. But the whales go wherever they want to. So it gives us a window into their sort of longer-term and larger-range movements.
Amazing. Now, you're doing some field work now on Oahu, but this is not the only location in Hawaii where you work. Where else will we see you in Hawaii and when?
Yeah, we tend to do anywhere between about 3 and 5 projects a year, and usually on at least 2 and sometimes 3 different islands a year. So in 2016, we had a short project in January off Oahu, then a project in February off of Kauai, in July off the Big Island, and then back here off Oahu in October. And so next year, we actually will be back to Maui Nui area. We'll probably be based on Lanai in March. Then a project on the Big Island in April, probably Kauai sometime in the summer, and back in the Big Island in the fall. So we try to spread the effort around to get a better idea of what's going on, what the differences among the islands are. And for some species, like false killer whales, they do move among the islands. So these ones that we tagged off Waianae may end up over off the Big Island in a couple of days. But for other species, they tend to be very island-specific populations. So the bottlenose dolphins and the spinner dolphins and the spotted dolphins that are off Oahu tend to remain off of Oahu, and they're different from the ones off Maui Nui or the Big Island.
Well, it's amazing that you've been able to culminate all of this knowledge into the book, The Lives of Hawaii's Dolphins and Whales. I'm very excited. Thank you for my copy. I look forward to going home and thumbing through all the images and reading through it. If people want to learn more or want to pick up the book, where can they go?
Yeah, the book is official publication date won't actually be till November, but it is available. I just got these advanced copies, but it is available for pre-order either on something like Amazon or at the University of Hawaii Press website as well. But it should be in bookstores here in Hawaii, I think, in late November. And on the mainland, it's released, I think, on November 30th. So.
Well, very exciting. Congratulations. And I look forward to hearing more about your work in Hawaii and definitely diving into this new book. I want to give a big thanks to my guest today for taking some time to share about their exciting research and interesting publications. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.